Okay, good evening. Thank you to everyone who was involved. Thank you, Hannah, for bringing me in, and Bracha. My name is Arya Clapper, speaking for the Center for Modern Torah Leadership, and particularly for a program called the Summer Beit Midrash, about which you can ask Bracha and Barak about afterwards attending. And I'm just going to give the shiur, and if you want to ask afterwards, you can talk to me about the program if you want. Okay, so the shiur is called Psak, Policy, and Inclusion. Nesiach Kepayim is an iconic and ironic example. And I'm trying to remember which one I came up with first, iconic or ironic. I gave it as a title to somebody, and then there was a typo, and decided the typo was cool, so it became both iconic and ironic. Well, I don't remember which one I intended originally, but the meaning of it is that Birgas Kohanim is obviously about as exclusive a prima facie a thing you can have in contemporary Orthodoxy, because not only is it limited to men, it's limited to Kohanim. And so it's kind of funny that a lot of the arguments about inclusion end up being about who, right, which male Kohanim can say Birkat, right, can say Birkat Kohanim. And I want to take you through probably three historical examples of the way in which Birkat Kohanim became a space for argument about topics or ideas of what and why should be included and excluded in certain communal functions, and see how, if you work out an overall thesis about this. Okay, I'm going to start with an article by Rabbi Dr. Benny Lau, who probably you now know of as the head of 929. So he wrote an article many years ago in which he said, Parshat Emor, or a little bit early, is bothersome because it says that Kohanim with physical blemishes are not fit to serve in the Beit HaMikdash, right? There's a whole list. You can't deny the Torah says there's a whole list of physical blemishes that disqualify male Kohanim from serving in the Beit HaMikdash. And that goes straight up, he said, against the contemporary notion that disability should not be a cause for exclusion. Okay, so that's he says that the answers that have been given by the Torah commentators, ancient and modern, do not ease the mind. Okay, right? Nobody has come up with a really good explanation of why such Kohanim are excluded. There are some memorably bad explanations, and there are some quite cool explanations. I think probably the coolest explanation is which shows you like how you can come right up against really, really grating against people's moral sensibilities and then maybe evade it, is the Meshech Chachma, who, if I recall correctly, says that physical blemishes reflect moral blemishes. Okay, now we're like really, no, can't say that. But God doesn't want to embarrass people about pointing out their moral blemishes, so he gives some people physical blemishes even though they don't have moral blemishes. But really, the reason that people with physical blemishes are excluded from the Beit HaMikdash is in order to exclude those people who have moral blemishes which are reflected in their physical blemishes. But there are a few people who are just victims of trying to keep people. That's a really wild explanation. It's not doesn't ease the mind, I don't think. But just to show you like where people have struggled. Okay, so we have that, right? We know we have a basic Torah principle which seems to say that we exclude the disabled, that physical perfection in some way is a qualification for divine service. As against that, you have a tshuva of the Marami Rotenberg, right? So already in the 13th century, right? Lest people think that we're introducing modern ideas into Torah. So the Marami Rotenberg says the following. You asked whether a person who has been, his language is a shenifgabo, shepagabo midat hadin, he was injured by the attribute of justice, God somehow took, punished him, it seems, and which the result of which is that it says the nafal is ro'o, he has some kind of, right, probably his arms are paralyzed. Ro'ui le'yosh shliach tzibur, such a person capable of serving, not as a kohen, but as a regular, right, as a regular shliach tzibur. Maybe we should say that people who have been injured by, right, that reflects the divine punishment, and such people, right, since we're praying for mercy, the last thing we need is somebody who has failed in their own prayers. To which the Maram Rotenberg replies, Shita de Ra'uy v'Ra'uyhu, it's obvious that this person is more than appropriate. Ve'ad Rabba, mitzvah min ha'mufchar, the reverse, this is the person you want specifically. The Melech Malchei Hamlachim, because the king of all kings wishes to use broken vessels. Right? His table service is read, is chipped china cups. And right, not like human kings, because it says that Lev Nishbar, God, broken downtrodden heart, that's what God does not despise. Okay, then the Maram says, by the way, what about Kohanim? And physical blemishes? Only Kohanim. Okay, that's a really interesting claim, right? So we always have
try and teach this way, right? That whenever you have a specific Torah law, you always have to decide, is it a paradigm or is it an exception? In Midrash Halakha, we say the question is this a chidush? Right, a chidush means it's something that surprises us, or is it a binyan av, something that makes sense to us, and therefore we generalize. And one of the most important things in the development of halakha and in the development of your own attitude towards halakha is on what basis you decide which are the things that you should generalize, and which are the things that you declare as exceptions. Right, so Rami Ruttenberg says it's true that Kohanim are excluded from the Beit HaMikdash because of physical blemishes, but you can't generalize that because actually that contradicts our conception of God, because God likes to use broken vessels. Now, we don't know why Kohanim are excluded from, right, why disabled Kohanim are excluded, but you can't learn anything from that to any other case.
Okay. So then, there is later a tshuva of the Chavot Ya'ir, which is not on the source sheet, which the Chavot Ya'ir is asked. Chavot Ya'ir is present in a synagogue where they appoint on Yom Kippur, or probably on the Yamin HaRaim, I don't know if it's Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, and they appoint a one-eyed man to be the Shliach, right, to be the Shliach Tzibur. And the Chavot Ya'ir objects to this. And he insists that they remove the one-eyed man as a Shliach Tzibur. And he gets a letter from, be careful when you read other articles about this, because some people get this exactly backwards. But the Chavot Ya'ir objects to the person, right, to the Shliach Tzibur, and then he gets a letter from a student who's saying, I don't understand why you objected. And the Chavot Ya'ir says, I know why you don't understand why I objected, because you don't understand why I objected. What does he mean by that? He says, you think I objected because I made the following argument. Well, prayer is a sacrifice. And if prayer is a sacrifice, then the Shliach Tzibur is a Kohen. And a Kohen can't serve as, right, and a Kohen with a physical blemish can't serve, right, can't serve at a sacrifice. How can a Shliach Tzibur, who has a blemish, serve as a prayer leader? So the Yair says, you think that's why I objected, and that's why you object? I agree with you, that's nonsense. Because God likes to use broken vessels. And he said, if that's true, then we shouldn't allow disabled people to pray for themselves. Because every person is bringing a sacrifice when they pray. So why are you talking only about the prayer leader? People, right, disabled people shouldn't be able to pray for themselves either. So he says that argument is wrong. However, the Chavot then says, but I still thought he shouldn't serve. Right, his grounds for that are not the subject of the shir, but you can see already, right, that the you can see how the analogy to kahuna is playing out. Okay, so now in the modern era, this moved into a question of Birkat Kohanim, where the question was asked whether Kohanim who use wheelchairs are allowed to do him, right? Can they do Birkat Kohanim, even though Birkat Kohanim requires standing? Okay, now we have to talk about how Birkat Kohanim functions. So Birkat Kohanim, right, there are rules about disability, but the rules about disability are not the same as the rules for service in the temple. The rules for excluding people with unusual physical characteristics from the Siyat Kohanim are entirely a question or a function of distraction for the community. If people will stare at them as opposed to thinking about the bracha, then they can't do it. And if people will, but if people won't stare at them, it doesn't matter. And therefore, a really interesting thing happens there, which is that there's nothing you can do to resolve the issue of disability for Kohanim in the temple. But if somebody has an unusual physical characteristic, like Gemara's example is they have permanently stained hands because they work as tanners. So if the community becomes used to them, then the disability is removed. Okay. So now Rabbi Lau had a really useful idea. He said, you know, maybe the way we should think about it as a community is not, well, here's a person, they have stained hands or some other unusual physical characteristic, so they want to do chen, so our reaction is, well, let's examine whether people are distracted by them or not. If people are distracted, right, we'll run some kind of test case. We'll have them stand in front of the room, and we'll see. Right, we'll run an eyeball test and see whether people are focusing on them or not. Rabbi Lau said, no, What we should do as a community is make sure that everybody becomes sufficiently used to it that it won't be a problem for Birkat Kohanim. And that's right. It's a moral inversion of right. As opposed to saying the question is asked after the fact, right? We have to say, look, this is potentially a problem of inclusion, and let's try and react differently. The analogy when we did this in the Sefer Midrash was, which I thought was an interesting analogy that an international lawyer brought in about whether wheelchairs are a disability or not, to some extent depends on whether your space is set up with steps or ramps. You can construct a world in which wheels are not a major disability, and maybe the moral job is, depending what the costs are, right, to try and create a universe in which things which would otherwise be disabilities are not. You can construct a world in which their consequences are diminished. So Rabbi Lau made the same argument here about Birkat Kohanim, that we should have a moral responsibility to create a society in which Kohanim with unusual physical characteristics are not excluded from Birkat Kohanim. That was a really fascinating argument. He tried to extend it to the Beit HaMikdash. That was a failure. But in terms of Birkat Kohanim, I thought it was a really powerful argument. And it raises the broader question, which I want to introduce to you, about conceptual halakha, about the extent to which we're supposed to have rooting interests in the halachic outcomes. As Rabbi Lau says, we're supposed to have a rooting interest. The rooting interest in the case of Kohanim with unusual physical characteristics is the rooting. We're supposed to want them to be able to say Birkat Kohanim. Now, if we can't, we can't. But we're supposed to want that outcome. And he talked about manipulating the psychology of the community in such a way as to enable that to happen. Now, the question is, should you also say that we should adopt the halachic possibilities that allow for that when there are a range of halachic options? So that question came up in the context of not in terms of visual disabilities, but there is a formal requirement that Birkat Kohanim has to be said standing. So what about people who are incapable of standing? Can they say Birkat Kohanim? People who are unable to get out of their wheelchairs. So the standard halacha was until very recently was that Kohanim were not or Kohanim who in wheelchairs could not say Birkat Kohanim because they couldn't stand. That was straightforward, and I showed you that the 20th century Bosik, the Shevet Halevi, Shmuel Wasner says there was one attempt to allow this by the Shvut Yaakov, but he was rejected by just about all poskim. Rabbi Wasner says he was pushed aside from halacha without any uncertainty. Okay, so that makes seems like we're stuck. But both Rabbi Dublinzer and I have ruled otherwise. I think probably it was already the 21st century when we first did this. But it might be interesting to examine what the grounds are because they give you some idea of what sorts of mechanisms people are willing to introduce in the service of rooting interests and what your boundaries of integrity are. So Rabbi Linzer tried to argue that all what standing means is to do the most you can. Right, because it's disrespectful to be sitting when you could be standing. But the obligation is really to put yourself in the most respectful possible position. And that solved the whole problem. The problem is that you're not saying why you're ruling differently than all the precedents. You're just coming up with, right, you're just saying that the precedents were wrong. I think, right, he wouldn't argue that, but I thought that was the case. So I argued instead that what should happen is that the ground for the Shvut Yaakov, when the Shvut Yaakov allowed Kohanim who couldn't stand to say Birkat Kohanim, his ground was that Birkat Kohanim is not really compared to the Avod, it's not really like the temple in this regard. So I found a Rishon that had not been available prior to the late 20th century, which supported this position. And on the basis of that Rishon, I argued that you could reread many other Rishonim who had been misunderstood.
And right, really, essentially, was the Rambam had been presumed the Rambam was reading the standard Vilna Shas, but actually he wasn't. Right, there was a different manuscript. Once we discovered that manuscript, then the Rambam made perfect sense. Once the Rambam made perfect sense, then the Shvut Yaakov was actually following the Rambam, and halacha could change that way. So you have two different ways in which you can. Right, one way is to think about reconceptualization of existing halacha, and one way is to say let's keep looking for the evidence, and maybe we'll find the things that enable us to paskin the way we think we ought. Okay, so that's one example of about Birkat Kohanim because of the relationship to the avodah and the Beit Hamikdash. Birkat Kohanim becomes sort of an interesting liminal point because it's it involves kuhuna, but it's not avodah. And now we have the question: do we try and say, well, we expand the paradigm of avodah? Or do we say that we minimize the standard of avodah? I think that the historical trend, even with the Chavurat Yair, is to follow the Marami Rotenberg, and to say that kuhuna is that blemishes excluding from kuhuna are the exception, and that therefore the right psak is to try and limit physical exclusions for physical characteristics to the extent possible, so long as you can make an argument that fits the canons of halacha. Okay, that's model number one. Yes, Brock.
Your approach isn't very sustainable in terms of long term. It relies on continually finding new evidence and being able to rule evidence in light of that. If our intuitions change in 300 years about how we should be ruling, then we're sort of stuck, like we're the added old Bishon manuscript.
So there are two kinds of arguments, right? One is really frum. The other really frum is answer is, you know, if you really believe this is the right psak for your time, then you'll get siyata d'shmaya, and the right sources will show up. If they don't, then you were wrong. But if you really believe that Torah is supposed to be moral, and this is supposed to be the moral outcome of Torah, then you'll probably find, right, then probably, you know, at the right time, the right makoros will show up. And then you'll say, but aren't you going to twist them? The answer, that's why you have to, you know, give shiurim and ask your friends and see if they're convinced, right? When the other version of this shiur I show, right, I had said, right, I think that other people made arguments that were unsustainable because they wanted to get there and they couldn't. But I think I could. And I'll give that shiur as a full-length shiur and you'll decide if you think I'm convincing. I do think that we live in an era which has two interesting characteristics. One is we have radical moral shifts, probably more than previously, and the other is we have massive amounts of new evidence in ways that just have never happened previously in halacha. Right, we have access to massive numbers of rishonim that nobody saw for 500 years. Not the Meiri, which everyone did have. but the other rishonim. So maybe it's Yad Nishmaya that we live in an era where, well, the manuscripts are online. Like, it's a really neat website, right? All of a sudden, I have access to manuscripts in a way that nobody's had for at least 500 years. Right, so I don't know that it's that making the frum argument is so hard. But you have to. It always has to be done with integrity. And the easiest test of integrity is, right, to try it on other people who might not feel as strongly about the moral position as you do, or right, whose integrity you trust, and they tell you whether this one works or is going too far. And then you try to stay friends with the ones who think you went too far, so that you can ask them again. Because if they all leave, that's sometimes is challenging. And also, sometimes people, you know, stop being friends because they don't think that you went far enough. It's hard to be honest and maintain friendships. I try. Yes, bro.
There's something.
Yeah.
He's posturing off of Tehillim, and then you're really using that as a really strong building.
I don't think he's passing off Tehillim. I think that there are lots of, you know, like that one verse could be multiplied 150 times, and if he didn't have the verse, it wouldn't care either. He's passing off his concept of God.
Right, but as in the fact that he doesn't have some other source for that is a bit like, as in having a source for halacha, until now, all halachic sources throughout the Gemara have basically said that physical blemishes are limiting and therefore granted it within the kahuna, but this is like a very radical approach to change that, and it seems like it's based off of Dale.
Well, I have to ask you, have you seen any place in which anybody prior to halacha used kahuna as an example to any other area of halacha? His answer is no. Right? This was obviously its own limited area. And right, and so the fact that nobody ever tried to expand it tells you that they didn't, right, that they thought it shouldn't be expanded. I think that would be his argument. But I agree, it's a very creative move to move from broken hearts to broken legs. Right, that's a very creative move. If someone tried it before them, right, before the Marami Rotenberg did, then that would probably not going to go over so well. But happily, Marami Rotenberg did it already. And Marami Rotenberg, right, this position is accepted universally. That's why the Chabad Yair is important, because even though he objected to it, he still thinks that this is correct halachically, and his objections are not halachic. So, right, so on the weight of tradition, it's not a difficult argument at all. Okay, great questions. People who don't know me in advance that have been in my shiur are also entitled to ask questions. Although you should, of course, come, so you'll feel more entitled. Okay, so second example. Now we are in 5710, which you can all figure out, right? We are in 1950. And Rav Moshe Feinstein gets a question from the famous Rabbi and Gaon, Rabbi Shlomo Yehuda Leib Levitan, the Gaon of Beit Din of Rock Island, Illinois, which is one of the really famous Jewish communities in North America, which all of you are fully familiar with the history of Rock Island, Illinois, I'm sure. Rock Island, Illinois had many synagogues. And like we forget that once upon a time Orthodoxy existed in small towns. And there were many synagogues, and Rock Island is one of the places, the last remaining place like this in North America, I believe, is Elizabeth, New Jersey, where there was one rabbi who rode circuit around the multiple synagogues. That was the rabbi and Gaon, Rabbi Shlomo Yehuda Leib Levitan. And he writes a question to Rav Moshe Feinstein. In which he asks him a question, which we should know about, of course. Like the thing about Rav Moshe Feinstein is that he never prints the question. He only writes his answer. So Rav Moshe says, "Your Honor's letter regarding whether public Sabbath desecrators can duchen, I received. My failure to respond was because this is among the matters that are hard to speak of." Okay, so the question apparently was, can Mechalei Shabbat Parhesia, public Shabbat desecrators, serve? I say Birkat Kohanim. And Rav Moshe says, "I got your letter and I didn't answer it because it's hard to speak about." That's an amazing thing. I'm sure that all of you have gone through most of Rav Moshe Feinstein's Shavuot, and there are lots and lots of them because he answers the questions. That's what he did, right? So I didn't respond to your letter because I didn't want to answer your question because it was hard. That's an astounding thing. I am only familiar with one other place, but I'm sure there are more. But I'm familiar with one other place. There's a place where Rav Moshe refuses to answer the question in writing and says, "Well, if we ever meet, I'm happy to talk to you about this." This is really wild. What's so hard about the question? Whether public Shabbat desecrators can do Birkat Kohanim. So this is a big sociological issue in North America, right? When you have an Orthodox community that is largely not Shabbat observant, right? We forget that also, right? It takes until somewhere in the early 70s for the Orthodox community to begin excluding the non-observant. Right, we become what I call a lean, mean Kirov machine. Right, but first you dispose of all the people who aren't from, and then you set out to try and make them from. Because before they were, you know, that's a whole interesting sociological question about to what extent denominational identification affects observance. You know, I'm trying to be glib about this. I say that, you know, in the United States, Orthodox identification is what, 6 to 10%. In England, Orthodox identification is 60 to 70%. But the percentage of Shmer Shabbat is about the same. Right, so denominational identification might not be the driver of observance, as opposed to the other way around in different cultures. Okay, so Rosh is dealing with a community, a largely non-observant but often formerly observant, community, and the question is, well, now you have a choice, because if you exclude them in a way that they, right, then that's, you'll lose them, but if you include them, then you lose the capacity to keep standards. So this is a very hard issue to talk about, but nonetheless, it's like the responsibility of Pokey to talk about it. So it's really weird that he doesn't get back to Rabbi Levitan. But now he says, "Okay, now you force me. You email me again. I got to tell you the truth." And here's what he says: "Look, you want to keep non-Shomer Shabbat from doing duchening. Why? Because because Kohanim can be disqualified for two sins from duchening. They can murder. Well, I can't tell you that public Sabbath desecration is murder, or they can worship idols."
Now, there is a Gemara that says the public Sabbath desecration is equivalent to worshiping idols. So you, Rabbi Levitan, he says, would like to exclude these non-Shomer Shabbat Kohanim on the basis of comparing them to idolaters. But then he says, hang on a sec. If somebody worships idols, according to the Rambam, right, if Kohen worships idols, they are permanently disqualified from temple service. Do you really want to say that even if these Kohanim, right, start being Shomer Shabbat, that they can't duchen? That, he says, is just crazy. Or he says this, but he has a phrase, he says, these are things that it is impossible to say. They're literally unspeakable. And therefore, he says, your argument, Rabbi Levitan, is just completely out of bounds. It can't be. Okay, so why wouldn't he tell him that? Right? If Rabbi Levitan's argument is just false, why would Rabbi Moshe not have told him this? So it happens that this time we have this interesting historical thing, because Rabbi Levitan's children published his Shuvot. And of course, pride of place among his Shuvot are the letter that he wrote to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. And Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's response, it turns out Rabbi Moshe wrote two responses, but the second one he didn't put Negros Moshe. But we have Rabbi Levitan's letter, and we have Rabbi Moshe's original response. Here's Rabbi Levitan's letter. This is Yirei Shlomo. Right? He said, he writes the letter on Motzei Rosh Hashanah of 5710. And he says, this is a life and death question, which is the way, right, the translation of Nafshi B'Sheilati, right, quoting Esther. And I have an urgent need to know before Yom Kippur. There is a layman here who's president of one of the synagogues. It's not an abstract question about Kohanim. There's a layman here who's president of one of the synagogues who drives to synagogue on Shabbat, and his store is open in the next town. So he's a public Shabbat desecrator who's a very prominent layperson. And I have always been able to sustain the position that public Shabbat desecrators can't duchen. And that's one of the ways in which our community establishes that it's still wrong not to keep Shabbat publicly. We're not going to keep you out of shul. You can't get up and bless the community, right? That I've managed to stand it. But now, you know, it's right, there are lots of shuls in town, and so they hire a chazanim for the Yom Tovim. And one of these chazanim has come in, right, and he's told this guy, he said, you're president of the shul, you can't do it. That's not going to work. So now this guy is, right, so now this guy is trying to do it. And he wants to do it, of course. How often does he come to shul? Twice a year. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and he wants to do it on Yom Kippur. Right, can I really have a public Sabbath desecrator doing Debrick and Kohanim? I don't want this at all. But I've always kept that. Now, I've always managed to keep this out. Now, it turns out, we discover later, that Rabbi Levitan had already asked this question. He had asked this question to the Ragashofer of Yisrael Rosen, who had told him, of course, no, of course you can't do that. How could you allow a Birka? How could you allow a Kohen who is Mechal Shabbos, Beferesia, to do him? And so Rabbi Levitan was really happy with his practice. He wasn't asking Rav Moshe because he wanted to know what the halacha was. He was asking Rav Moshe because in his community, nobody knew who the Ragashofer was. And so politically, it was insufficient, right? Politically, he was, right, it was not sufficient for him to have the Ragashofer's psak. So he needed Rav Moshe to write him a letter before Yom Kippur that he could put up in shul and said, look, I asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, and Rav Moshe Feinstein said that Kohanim were not Shomer Shabbat, can't, right, Bevaresia can't do it. Now, if you look at the letter he was originally from Moshe, Rav Moshe's response to him is, I received your letter between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur in due time. And I delayed answering it. Right, he answers it on the 28th of Mar Cheshvan, because Rav Moshe knew that his answer was not the answer Rabbi Levitan needed. If he wrote his true answer, that would demolish Rabbi Levitan. So he refused to answer the question because he tells you that he thinks it's probably good policy to exclude Kohanim, right? If you already have the policy of excluding Kohanim, it's probably good policy to maintain that. But I can't honestly tell you that it's justified halakhically. Okay, so here we have another place where Birkat Kohanim becomes like the test case for inclusion versus exclusion. And the psak is one way, but the policy is the other way, and Rav Moshe navigates it by refusing to answer the question, which is really fascinating. Now later on, a Rabbi Ulis from Syracuse writes to Rabbi Levitan and says, you have it completely backwards. If your policy is sustained,
there will be no Kohanim left in North America, because the only reason they don't intermarry is because they get respected, because they do Pirkei Kohanim. And if you tell people who aren't Shomer Shabbos that they can't do it anymore, they're all going to intermarry, and then there'll be no Kohanim left. So you, Rabbi Levitan, your policy will be responsible for the end of Kuna in North America. And you better find some way of allowing them to do it. So it's interesting, right? So the policy arguments go both ways, just like the halachi arguments, and people try to work out trick ways. What happens if you call another coin up and this one just comes up under cover of that one? All sorts of interesting things like that. Okay, that's example number two, and now we will move into the sort of contemporary world. Igros Moshe Yerdeh, right on page 3, right? Igros Moshe Yerdeh 258 talks about a coin who was taken into the army during war or killed in the war. So remember, we have a Gemara that says that a coin who kills, coin who regeta nefesh, and no seid kapab. A coin who kills can't do him. So can coinim who are drafted into the army and killed as part of their service, can they do him? And Rav Moshe says, of course. That doesn't apply to people who are coerced to kill. And if you're drafted in the army, so now you're in a situation where it's kill or be killed, so you're allowed to kill. And the whole rule is only against Kohanim who make choices about killing. And then he says, you know what, this is true, even in situations where the Kohen was not justified in killing. But so long as he was acting under compulsion, even though he should have refused the order, he's still obvious he's allowed to do it. Okay, that was an obvious question. Right, Kohanim. Right, Kohanim. When we say a Kohen who kills somebody, it only means somebody who kills somebody voluntarily. But Moshe says it's obvious that even if you kill somebody illegally, right, you're in a situation which should be a hirig vel yavor, you should have to give up your life rather than kill that person. It's obvious that you get to do. Okay, that's right. Now we've lowered the standard for killing dramatically. Rav Avad Yosef gets a shaila about a Kohen taxi driver who runs over a pedestrian. Now, he didn't run the pedestrian over deliberately. He might not even have run the taxi driver over the pedestrian over culpably. He hasn't been criminally convicted. Right? He was just in an accident where he hit a pedestrian, and the pedestrian died. And the question is, he allowed to do Birkei Kohanim? So Rav Avadia begins by quoting the Gemara in Brachot. A Kohen who killed a nefesh may not duchen, as it says, when you spread your palms, I will hide my eyes from you because your hands are full of blood. Then he says, you know what? There's the position of Pri Chadash. Right? I excerpted this. The position of Pri Chadash. Pri Chadash says what Rav Moshe said, that if you weren't responsible for the action, it's okay. So, right, the pedestrian ran into the road. Right. It's not right. You didn't do anything wrong. So of course you should be allowed to do it. But then instead of ending where Rav Moshe did with a soldier, Rav Avadia says, but the Prima Gadim doesn't like the Pri Chadash. And you know what? So this is a case of Safek Brachot and Safek Brachot Lakel. So unless you are absolutely 100% totally positive that there's nothing whatsoever you could have done to avoid hitting that pedestrian, you should not do it. Okay, so now we have what seems like a machloket between Rav Avadia and Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe paskins that it's right that the standard is you have to kill somebody willingly, culpably, right? Right? It's only if you murder somebody, essentially, according to Rav Moshe, that you can't do him. And Rav Avadia says no, it was right. It's that you can't do him if you have any degree of culpability whatsoever. Yes, Bracha. No, that's all there is. Once you get up, you have a mitzvah asay to do the bracha, and if you don't do the bracha, then you're right. Then you're mevatel an asay. So that right. So you're better avoid not going up. You're better off not going up. Okay. So that's great. We have this right. This halachic dispute between Rav Moshe and Rav Avadia about the standard, and then Rav Avadia gets another question. The question he gets is, Kohanim who are soldiers in the IDF, who participated in battle and killed enemy soldiers, are they allowed to do it? Well, you should expect the tshuva to expect the tshuva to say, well, you know, this is right. This is a machlokes between the Pri Chadash and the Pri Megadim, and we should be choshesh for the Pri Megadim and not allow them to duchen. You all probably figured out Rav Adya doesn't say that at all. And this is one of his famous of tshuvot where he says, you should not think that absolutely, absolutely, absolutely not. You did a mitzvah. Right, and of course we paskin like the Pri Chadash, and not only that, this is much better than the case of the Pri Chadash, because here you were allowed to kill. It wasn't Hirg Vel Yavor at all. It was a Bala Hargacha Hashkem Largo, and therefore Rav Adya says that I want you to know that you as IDF soldiers, right? There's nobody could possibly raise an issue about IDF soldiers being allowed to duchen because this is a veteran of the 67 war, right? Because they killed soldiers. Okay. Right, so Rav Adya is a little bit inconsistent, but we understand why, right? Because he thinks that there's a good public policy reason to encourage people to drive safely, and it's really bad public policy to have Kohanim and the IDF worrying about firing their guns at the enemy. Yes?
He didn't say the first thing. It's about policy.
He didn't say it, but we have to figure out what's the difference between the two tshuvot, right? One tshuvot, he says, right, we should be choshesh to the people of Gadim, and the other tshuvot, he says, why would you even think about that? Okay, you could say that if you want. Rav Moshe said that the default is the other way. Okay. But then, this is a tshuva that Rav Adya has in Yechaved Da'at. Rav Adya has two collections of tshuvot. Right? He has Yabia Omer and Yechaved Da'at. Yechaved Da'at, the standard yeshivish assumption is, Yechaved Da'at was a radio show that Rav Adya answered the questions live. But if you look at Yechaved Da'at, there are often footnotes that are added right asterisk in, and so my suspicion is that that's the stuff he added in afterwards. And, you know, the radio show, right, the transcript of the radio show, and he says, oh, I forgot this and that, right, so he puts in the footnote. So there's an interesting footnote on this tshuva. So here, Rav Adya says, prima facie, one can challenge the claim that soldier kohanim can duchen from Divrei HaYamim 1 Aleph Chaf Bet Chet, where Hashem says to King David, Damim l'rov shafachta, you have spilled blood in abundance and made great wars. You will not build a house for my name. You cannot build the Beit HaMikdash because you have spilled much blood to the ground before me. Right? So So even though he fought the words of Hashem, the holy blood, that shouldn't be italicized, I'm sorry, that's not part of the quote. Even though he fought the words of Hashem, the holy blessed, he did not allow the temple, did not wish the temple to be built by his hands. Okay, right, so it sounds like, he says, right, if David HaMelech couldn't build the Beit HaMikdash because he spilled blood in war, so maybe, right, and the Beit HaMikdash is just like Birka Kohanim, because they're both things that symbolize peace, so maybe you shouldn't be allowed to do it. But he says, don't think that, because Radak there says, right, that when it says you've shed in abundance, that refers to innocent blood. It refers to the blood of the Kohanim of Nov, who David caused to be massacred by asking for their help when Shaul was mad at him. It refers to also the blood of the nations that he spilled who were not B'nai Milchamto, and perhaps among them were good and pious people. B'nai Milchamto is a complicated phrase. We're going to misinterpret it now as civilians because that's how it's misinterpreted by other people. Doesn't mean that, but we're going to misinterpret it that way. Nonetheless, he was not punished for this because his intent was to wipe out the wicked lest they make a breach in Israel. However, because abundant bloodshed had came about through him, so because he wasn't punished for killing the wrong people because his intentions were good, but he wasn't allowed to build the Beit HaMikdash because he killed people he shouldn't have killed. Injustified wars. Okay, so Rav Adya says, but that teaches you that fighting, right, that killing as part of a just war is not per se a disqualification. And you, IDF soldiers, right, who did you kill? You killed enemy soldiers. Enemy soldiers are B'nai Milchamto. David was only prevented from building the Beit HaMikdash because he killed people who were not B'nai Milchamto. So since all your, right, you can be confident as an Israeli soldier that you only killed people who are, right, enemy soldiers, therefore you are fine. All right, and that's the inspirational operation, right? You know, that you, right, you fought a Milchamet Mitzvah, right? All your, right, and therefore everything you did is justified. So this is one of the things that's it's a really great, powerful tshuva to write to a veteran of the 1967 war. But it might not be the best shiva to write to a veteran of the Lebanon War. So there is a work, a contemporary work called Chashukei Chemed by Rav Yitzchok Zilberstein. And the most important thing to know about Chashukei Chemed is that it is not a work of halakha and should never, ever, 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 ever be quoted by anybody in any context which is relevant to halakha l'masa, except for me. Because I'm going to do that now. But I'm telling you, friend, that you should not think that this is because he said halakha l'masa, is because he's really, he tells you in the introduction that he's writing these as exercises for students to show them how sugyot can apply to real life, but not paskening. And the ideas are interesting, and so we'll figure out what you think of this idea. So he also tells us that these are not, so far as I can tell, they're not real questions. They're questions that he enjoys making up. There is, I think, a doctor be written on how sometimes rabbis who are really, really love writing fiction, but think that it's pastnish to write novels, instead they write shilohs. And there are some really, really great shilohs written that way. I have an article about why this one shiloh that, where the story goes on for like 5 or 6 pages, little turns of miraculous turns and things like that. Just really, somebody really enjoyed telling the story. And I argue that Chavot Yair specifically. Chavot Yair is a series of Chavot which begin, there's a story that someone told me. And then go on, like they're really amazing, they're amazing stories. There's one where there's a rich guy and his daughter gets deathly ill. And no one's willing to treat her because she's contagious. So he says, whoever treats my daughter will be able to marry her. And of course, the stablehand says, I will treat your daughter. And so, right, he has to see the Princess Bride. What can you do? And so the stablehand comes, and of course, she's healed. And of course, what happens? He says, no, right? Of course, I don't love you. I only said that. And then the stablehand falls sick, and the daughter says, I don't care, I'm going to go nurse him, and she nurses him back to life, and then turns into a shiloh about the dowry. the story is great. There's another one I just love telling, right, where a guy and his son is about to cross the border, and these two women come up to him and say, we don't have border passes, we'll be fined massively if we have to pay massive taxes if we cross the border, but if we claim that we're your wives and it's a family and we don't have to pay. So he says, okay, right, you can kind of find my carriage and cross the border. And they get to the border and the guard looks at them and says, that's your wife? I don't believe that's your wife. She's way too young for you. No, really, it's my wife. Okay, prove it, kiss her. But of course, she's Nida. And now the question is, are you allowed to violate, right, to violate Yisurim, their chokos of Nida, as long as it's not derechiba, of course, right, it's just because you're trying to evade taxes, so are you allowed, right, that's what the shaila is. The question is much more fun. So there might be a whole genre of rabbinic romances that are not, until it became okay in the late 19th century. In Germany, when it became suddenly okay for people to write romances. And then you have, because you had to compete, because the yeshiva students were reading romances also, and then you get the amazing novels of Marcus Lehmann, which you have not read, probably. But they're in English. They're published by Feldheim. They're really fun. The yeshiva guy is hired by the king to tutor the princess. But of course, he's supposed to tutor the princess in geometry, but she is so impressed with his modesty and his morals that she decides she wants to convert. But of course, the king won't allow her to convert, so they run away. These are all, they're much fun, much fun. Okay, so here's the Chashukei Chemed. Chashukei Chemed says, here's a story. There's a guy who says that many years ago he was involved in a counterterrorism episode, and they killed all the terrorists, but he's not sure. Maybe one of the terrorists was raising his hands before he was shot. And he has nightmares in which the guy he shot, the guy he shot appears to him in dreams and says, right, and says, why did you shoot me? I was raising my hands. And the question he asks is, do I need kapara? For having shot this terrorist. So the Chashukei Chemed says, no, it's war. It's really, really hard to tell in war, right? And it could always be a trick. They're raising their hands, but have another weapon underneath. So I don't think you should feel guilty at all. But he says, I have to tell you that when the time comes to build a Beit HaMikdash, you probably shouldn't be part of that. Because after all, there's this Radak. It says the Vedas killed. Then he said, but don't worry about it, because we're Ashkenazim and we think the third Beit HaMikdash is going to come down in fire anyway, so nobody's going to be involved in building it. So it's not right. So it's not such a big deal. Okay, that's a fun intellectual exercise. But once we realize that that the standards for building the Beit HaMikdash and the standards for Birkat Kohanim are the same, so the reason for disqualification in both cases is that they're supposed to be symbols of peace. Or Doc actually brings the fasting analogy of that. Like it's like you can't use metal to cut the rocks with the Mikdash. So Rav Zilberstein, if you thought his argument, what he points out is that the implication of Rav Avadia's argument is that maybe Kohanim who engage in morally ambiguous war acts involving killing the enemy can't do Birkat Kohanim. And now we get into a really quick question. There's the halachic question. What do you think? Do you think that Kohanim who kills civilians accidentally, but perhaps in a way they could, right? But perhaps, you know, on the analogy of the taxi driver, accidentally doesn't mean there was nothing you could have done better, but we'll have an investigation afterwards, which will show you exactly what you could have done better, right? So do we think that, right, halachically, that such kohanim are allowed to do it? And then we have the policy question. Do you think that it's better to say, of course, such kohanim can do it, because it would be terrible if we create a situation where soldiers who are kohanim are afraid of firing in cases of mortal danger because they don't want to lose the capacity to say Birkat Kohanim? Or do we think that that's really a great thing to have in an army in a difficult, in a morally challenging environment where there's so much temptation to shoot people unnecessarily because you're under such constant threat and such strain? Maybe it would be the best, I mean, amazing policy to say, look, we take this really seriously to the point that even if you are fully exonerated by an army inquiry, the standard we'll give you for yourself is if there's anything you could have done, you can't do it. So I think it's a really interesting policy question. I have to think about, to what extent should that policy be, right? If I were to say write a tshuva about this with a less dramatic, perhaps, introduction. But not at all inconceivable that one of my students who is a veteran could ask me this question. To what extent do you think the answer should be framed as halacha? To what extent do you think the answer should be framed as policy? To what extent do you think it's legitimate to present what I think is the right policy as the halachic outcome, which it could be. All right, so that's the end of my presentation. If you followed that and enjoyed it, so then you understand what the Sefer Beit Midrash is like. And if you want to learn that, if that's the way you want to learn, then I encourage you to consider applying. And if, you know, for some reason, there's absolutely nothing whatsoever you could conceivably do so as not to come for one or multiple summers, then you can, you know, at least follow the podcast and read the weekly Dvar Torah, and if, you know, whatever, donate millions of dollars, whatever, whatever sort of way you feel is most appropriate to support the kind of learning. All right, thank you. Are there other questions? Yes.
You mentioned like the Rome way of approaching, like changing, like posting. How, like, what would you respond to people who say that, like where does the line end, like for your quality of reading in this day and age?
So I'm gonna try and give a cheap answer, but then you're welcome to come learn, and we can have like a long, long conversation. There's a famous story in the Gemara there, you know, where the Gemara is trying to debate at what point you know whether, what point you know if you find a dove on the floor, at what point can you assume that it didn't come from the neighbor, from a neighboring dovecot, and you can keep it for yourself because it's lost. And the Gemara gives a measurement. Right? If it's this far from the dovecot, then, right, if it's within this distance, this radius of the closest dovecot, then you have to assume it belongs to the owner of that dovecot. Anything beyond that is yours. And Rabbi Yirmiyah comes along and says, you know, the question is, what if the dove has 1 foot inside and 1 foot outside? And the reaction is, they throw them out. Because there are never lines.
that are absolute. Right? There's always going to be a border. Right. So the question is, are you within the, are you engaging, using reasonable halachic methodology? You know, the question, like, can I draw a red line? And I say, this is it. I could, but someone else will draw it a different place. And, you know, and people exclude different people arguments that way. And, you know what, there are lots of posts who have 1 foot on the inside the line and 1 foot, right, and 1 foot out. I'll say, you know, I used to, when I was younger, I used to obsess about the question, like, are my values really totally purely internal in Torah? Or, you know, was I corrupted because I read secular books on occasion? Right, so there's a reductio ad absurdum of the argument where people, you know, people say, like, you know, if you're even one, right, you have to have pure das Torah. Okay, good. So nobody has pure das Torah, right? Like, I showed the picture of this guy with the newspaper, right? His troops are all out. You know, not to mention the, I was saying, I got to quote that somebody once told Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, this is in the infamous book, The Making of a Gadol, I think, we really need to produce popular literature like Marcus Lehman for yeshiva students, right, to avoid them being corrupted, right, because, you know, they need light reading. And he said, what's wrong with Agatha Christie? I think that there are no poskim who don't say radically new things in response to radically new circumstances. Everyone does. And keeping things the same in the face of radical new circumstances is also right, because no one ever said this in that circumstance. So I don't think the right question is to ask where the line is. The right question is to ask, what process am I following? And biggest thing is, who am I checking myself against to make sure that I'm being honest? Like, to me, the most important thing is to have friends, both your friends who are Tumei Chachamim and friends with your Shemayim you trust, and students, who will call you on it if they think you're being dishonest. And if you stick to your position, if you find yourself consistently saying things that your friends tell you are ridiculous, even though they basically agree with you, you know, and with where you're trying to go, then probably you should, you know, say, like, I'm not doing this right. And I, you know, I have said this to some of my friends. Like, you know, everyone tells you that what you're saying is ridiculous. You should rethink it. And it bothers me when they don't rethink it in that regard. And I'm not aware of having done that myself. But the only way to really prevent it long term is to come learn. And you can be the one who yells at me. All right. Thank you so much. I hope we'll be in touch. Yeah, so if people could please sign up. That entitles you to the weekly email. And once I will send you a Sefer Beit Midrash brochure. And that's it. But everything else is just Torah. And it's all.